This is ABC Radio National.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Was I a weird kid, or did you have these conversations with your mates too about how you wanted to die? I remember at the ripe age of probably 9, declaring I wanted to die in my sleep the night after my 100th birthday. And you know, that still doesn't sound too bad for me, but how far would you be willing to go to make sure you last a century? Eat veggies every day? Load up on supplements? Have all the plasma drained from your body and replaced periodically? Longevity is big business at the moment. It's birthed a new unofficial disorder, longevity fixation syndrome. But how much control do we actually have over how long we live? Also ahead, what makes a voice sexy? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, AC/DC, In Excess, Paul Kelly, what do these now iconic Australian artists who can sell out stadiums have in common? They cut their teeth playing to 100 people, if they were lucky, in a pub. But right now, it's never been harder to be a small live music venue in Australia. You've got multinational companies squeezing the market, an onerous regulatory environment, and a young generation who doesn't drink alcohol. This all works against venues trying to turn a profit. Music lovers say it's never been about the money. So what if there was another way to set up these small rooms where big things start if you didn't need to make a profit? From you this morning, I would love to know about the time you were there before a band was famous. Tell me about the small dingy room where you saw a now famous band play. And in our tick, you'll meet someone who spent the last year travelling around the UK and Europe researching alternative funding models for small live music venues. But first, let's understand the issue here in Australia. Ant McKenna is the General Manager of the Australian Live Music Business Council and is with me right now. Ant, what kind of pressures are small venues in Australia facing today?
Hey, Tegan, and hi, everyone. Yes, we are in the middle of a really massive global change where traditionally venues made their money from alcohol sales and artists made their money from ticket sales. But young people aren't drinking as much, which is great, and that's happening globally. Audiences have limited cash. People are finding music online rather than just kind of bumping into it in their local venues. People are purchasing later. They're purchasing international major shows rather than small local shows. And the algorithm and major company cash supports intensifies and cements that kind of purchasing culture. At the same time, venues are really faced with the cost of everything increasing, insurance premiums, you know, skyrocketing. Alcohol costs, power costs, production costs, administrative burdens such as superannuation. And we've lost a stack of venues. I was there on Saturday night to see the last gig at the Soul Bar on the Sunshine Coast, a 20-year-old venue that, you know, everyone thought was in an amazing spot and doing incredible things and had just suddenly announced it was closing. So these spaces are where, as you mentioned, our young artists cut their teeth, and also all the industry workers that go along with them, the young promoters that learn how to put on gigs, other music workers, production workers, etc. So, you know, I guess the question is, does our community value those spaces? What do we lose when we lose those spaces? Do we want to just find music on our devices that's fed to us by major international companies? You know, do we want to be able to have that experience that I had growing up, which is bumping into amazing artists, seeing Paul Kelly when there's six other people in the room and those kind of things, you know, those opportunities to hear people tell amazing stories about who we are as a culture.
Also with me is Sam Whiting, who's just completed a Churchill Fellowship researching funding models for live music venues overseas. Sam, listening to Ant there, he's painting a pretty grim picture.
Yeah, it's tough out there, particularly post-COVID. You know, there's been shocks to supply. Inflation has had a massive impact. In Australia, insurance premiums have gone up. That was something that I didn't see overseas, so that seems to be a uniquely Australian problem with our insurance market for venues. But then, as Ant mentioned, people aren't drinking as much, especially young people. So changes to audience behaviour is really affecting the bottom line of music venues. And there's also been demand flight to larger arena and stadium events. So what we're seeing is people are still going to see a lot of live music, but it's more your Taylor Swift's than your local Australian rock band or local artist in a small to medium venue. So there's been some really big changes, and a lot of that has been on this side of the pandemic. The pandemic really was sort of like a kind of a structural circuit breaker for the sector. And a lot of venues are struggling to adapt and to keep up.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Ant McKenna from the Australian Live Music Business Council, and Sam Whiting, who's a Churchill Fellow who's just been travelling around Europe and the UK, looking at alternative funding models for live music venues overseas. We'll get into what he found in just a tick. It's a really interesting approach to it, but I have been asking you also to tell me about the place where you saw a band that's now super duper famous back in the day. You have been rushing to tell me, to brag to me about who you saw. Mel says, I saw Gotye with the Basics at the Northcote Social Club in Melbourne. His cover of Sting's Roxanne was amazing. Another person says, I saw Daddy Cool in the Glenelg Town Hall, one of their early concerts. Couple of people saw Midnight Oil at their uni. Katie saw them at the Adelaide Uni Bar in O Week in the late 80s. Another person saw them at the ANU Refectory and the Huda Gurus at the UNE Refectory in 1984. Damien saw in a small hall in Rosebud, Victoria in the 1970s. I went to see Split Enz. It cost 20 cents to get in. 20 cents! Sam, what does that compare to what it costs to see live music these days?
Well, I actually still think gigs to small to medium venues are too cheap. I think one thing that was really apparent when I was traveling in the UK and Europe last year in my fellowship is that entry was always double the price of a pint, right? So if a pint was £5, it'd be £10 to get in. And what I've noticed across the small to medium sector for a long time is that the price of beer keeps rising, but we're not charging more for small to medium gigs. So I think we have a problem where we don't really value as a society, but also as a sector, that end of the talent pipeline, so to speak. So what I've been looking at is alternative ownership and operating models for venues to sort of re-emphasize the cultural and sort of the public value of music for our communities.
So what have you found? It's a not-for-profit model that you're looking at, isn't it?
Well, yeah, not necessarily. So what I identified was two core problems for Australian music venues. So the security of tenure, like they don't often own the buildings that they're operating out of. So they, you know, rent could go up to prohibitive level overnight, or they could be the owner of the building might want to sell to developers. So that's a structural issue. Location is obviously very important for venues, and they can't just pick up and move. The other thing was financial sustainability. And so in Australia, our default model for small to medium venues is a for-profit, commercially run small business operating out of usually a leased premise, and that opens up all sorts of structural vulnerabilities which aren't reflected overseas. So in the UK, more and more venues are moving towards a not-for-profit model, specifically a community interest company. So that's a specific legal form in the UK that looks and sounds like a limited company, like your local pub or small business. Not much has to change in that respect, but they are registered as a not-for-profit. They're eligible for tax concessions. And if the business were to be wound up, it can't be sold at a profit. So it has that sort of more embedded structural kind of connection to the community, in that it is not just a local pub with bands on, but it also has that kind of not-for-profit social enterprise string to its bow.
And listening to that kind of business model, what is that saying to you about the Australian landscape?
Yeah, I think they're all Sorry, Sam. Yeah, they're all great ideas. And, you know, there are places like Lazy Thinking in Sydney and Elixir Bar in Cairns that are doing the same thing. The Castlemaine Community Hub that's set up a cooperative. Our laws in Australia don't make it as easy to do that as it is in the UK, but there's opportunities for us to advocate to make that happen. For me, that's, I guess, just one of the options. I love the idea of small businesses that can be agile and the people that run them feel like that absolute ownership rather than, you know, just having to move to a not-for-profit model. I think we need to look at what the expenses are. So things like tax relief, things like funding for artist fees, things like funding for youth culture passes or similar that happen in France, the way governments can support things like entertainment precincts, an arena ticket levy is a thing that the ALMBC has done a lot of work on, building a foundation to make that happen. My Gig Pass, which is a great initiative by the Live Music Venues Alliance in New South Wales, things like public transport even. So there's all kinds of things that we could and should be working on. But I love also this idea of not-for-profit leadership as well.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. We're talking about live music and how to keep venues able to operate at a profit or at a not-for-profit here in Australia. I'm asking you about the spot where you saw a van that's now super famous. You are absolutely blowing up the text line for me with some really impressive names. Marina says, I saw Keith Urban in a small pub in his early days. There were barely 10 people in the pub. His career took off very soon after that. Another says, I saw the young group calling themselves the Brothers Gibb at the Pink Elephant on Cavill Avenue Surfers Paradise in 1967. They later changed their name to the Bee Gees. I saw them next in Miami, Florida in 1984. Another, INXS played Tuesdays at the Ambassador in Newcastle in the late 70s. Ticket price, $1. And another one, growing up in Melbourne's West in the 70s, AC/DC played at our high school social. Different times, you can say that twice. Well, someone mentioned Lazy Thinking in Sydney before. We've actually got Jim Flanagan, who owns that small music venue here. Jim, tell me about your business model, please.
Hey there. We are a not-for-profit music venue that is still in the transitional stage of moving to a full charity status. And just listening to your other guests, I agree with a lot of the commentary that's been discussed already. It is extraordinarily tough out there, I think, for any small music venue. From our perspective, and I think you've covered the main issues already. The reason that we moved to a not-for-profit is that I don't think the small model of running a music venue really works anymore. And I think you've covered the reasons for that really, really well. In our case, we're at 100 capacity, slightly under that music venue. And the figures just don't add up. The alcohol consumption is a major force. I agree that that's no bad thing. I've never really fully been comfortable with that as a major income stream for venues anyway. I think that's a force for good. But that does mean that one of the traditional, you know, main income streams just isn't there anymore. In my case, you know, I run a venue in Sydney. Sydney side is a very, very fickle. It's very difficult and challenging to get people to come out to a music venue in numbers. We are entirely reliant on the community that comes out for individual performances at the venue. And look, in our case, and I think this is reflected of a number of other small business models and small music venues that I've certainly talked to, it just doesn't work anymore. So if you look at the costs of running the venue, you talked about insurance, rent, the uncertainty running a business where you don't own the property, it just doesn't really work. Our costs are too high. Our income streams aren't there. We want to make sure that we pay the artists as well. So in our case, Lazy Thinking has only been able to survive over the last 2.5 years through basically myself working full time to try and raise money elsewhere, either through a mixture of government funding or philanthropic donations. We've never charged for use of the space, and we evolved, I guess, as a music venue from a record label that was trying to support and help emerging artists, and we've always prioritised that in our programming. So in our case, it's perhaps a little bit different in that a lot of the activity that we were doing organically when we first set up was defined as a charitable purpose, so it was a little bit easier to start to make that transition. But yeah, look, from our perspective, the small business model of working as an existing and surviving as a for-profit organisation just doesn't work. I do agree with some of the commentary earlier that I don't think we're looking at a future where we are exclusively working with the not-for-profit sector. To terribly misquote Tony Blair, we need a mixed economy, right? We absolutely need successful small, medium, and large operators in the live music sector as well. But I do think we need a significantly larger not-for-profit sector. And I've looked at real interest at what's happening in the UK and Europe, where they have a significantly large not-for-profit sector in the independent music community. And that provides all sorts of benefits. So I think the government has done a pretty good job of identifying the problem that we're all talking about today. And there are lots of new funding opportunities available for the live music sector and specifically small and medium term venues. But when you become a not-for-profit or a charity organisation, there are all sorts of other funding opportunities that you can potentially tap into. So, clearly it's a much more compelling organisation to donate for on private philanthropic donations. But you move away from a lot of the tactical project-based funding opportunities that are currently on the offering and have increasingly been so over the last couple of years for the independent music community. And they're great and they're really, really important. And just to be clear, they have helped us survive over the last couple of years. But you're then moving to a model where you have potentially access to larger, more strategic, longer term funding opportunities. And this is how a lot of larger organizations outside of the music industry, your theatre companies, your opera companies, your fine music organizations survive. There is a far more prevalent presence in the not-for-profit and charitable sector there, which allows them to systematically fundraise and to, like I said, potentially gain access to longer-term, more strategic funding opportunities. And I personally think that the independent music community and the live music scene is missing a beat and is a little bit behind in perhaps evolving to more of that hybrid mixed economy model.
You're talking about opening up funding opportunities. That needs to be funded by someone. Sam, talk to me about the ticket levy that you observed in the UK.
Yeah, I completely agree with what was just said. I just looked at the stadium and arena levy that's come into effect in the UK through a lot of lobbying from the Music Venue Trust. So the Music Venue Trust is a registered charity itself and acts as a peak body for small and medium venues. And as was just mentioned, they sort of identify that there's a real structural problem with the way the small to medium venues are run and new revenue streams are needed. So they've lobbied quite hard for about 10 years to get a stadium and arena ticket levy up. The UK government identified a levy as a structural way of addressing sort of this imbalance between major arena shows in the small to medium sector. And rather than legislating that levy, they said to the sector, well, we really think you should come up with a voluntary levy. We think you, as a bunch of stakeholders, should get together and come up with your own model. We're going to give you a timeline. Here's 2 years. If you don't come up with your own model for implementing a ticket levy on large events, we're going to legislate a mandatory levy. So that was a really interesting way of creating sort of political pressure for the sector to get together. And, you know, all parts of the sector, small to medium venues, major promoters like Live Nation, festivals, artist managers. So all of the UK music sector got together and they came up with a new organization called Live Trust. And Live Trust is set up specifically to administer the £1 per ticket levy on events over the size of 5,500 capacity. So we're talking arenas and all the way up to your major stadium concerts. And that's already started to pay out dividends. You know, that they've just done the first round of funding announcements from the last 6 months of revenue collection from that levy. And it's made quite a substantial difference to the small to medium sector, as well as emerging artists and promoters as well. So that's definitely something that we should be looking into here in Australia.
On the text line, you're telling me, Greg in Griffith says, what you're describing as not-for-profit clubs has happened in the country regions for a century. They were bachelor and spinsters events, but the insurance and compliance makes it untenable and those institutions are collapsing. Another says community radio is running or supporting small regional venues. Big problem is young people don't come. Audience at a small local hall last night, all over 40. And if there was one thing you could change tomorrow that would make things better for small live music venues and by extension artists, what would it be?
I think probably two things. One is to ensure that kind of funding support and initiatives that support venues, grassroots live music venues, reduce their costs, are normalised all across every state. So New South Wales is doing very well. The kinds of things that Jim mentioned before are amazing in New South Wales, but in other states, we are really falling behind. So to have that equalised across all the states and to have all of the states work together would be amazing. But then also the thing that happens in major sporting codes globally is that those major sporting codes do fund the grassroots because they know where that's the next car racing driver is going to come from or the next goal kicker. So that doesn't really happen yet in music and it needs to happen. And so the arena ticket levy is a part of that. So I guess those two things to me are really key changes that need to happen.
Ant, Jim, Sam, thank you all so much for chatting with me this morning. Ant McKenna is the General Manager of the Australian Live Music Business Council. Jim Flanagan's the owner of not-for-profit live music venue Lazy Thinking in Sydney. And Sam Whiting is a Churchill Fellow who's been researching alternative funding models for live music venues overseas. Thank you for your humble braggy texts too. One says, my 17-year-old son just bought tickets to see the Hilltop Hoods at the Rod Laver Arena for $170. I remember seeing them in a small venue in Canberra in the early 2000s for about $20. Good times. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, can you get so obsessed with living longer that it actually affects your health?
Smarten up your afternoons on ABC Radio National each weekday at 1:30. On Mondays, it's The Science Show.
Every Tuesday, I ask, what the duck? Science Friction on Wednesdays. All in the Mind on Thursdays.
Then on Fridays, What's That Rash?
And Lab Notes.
You bring the lunch.
We'll bring the science.
We'll bring the science.
1:30 weekdays, right here on ABC Radio National.
Can I ask you a personal question? Do you have an age you reckon you'd like to live to see? What lengths would you go to in order to reach it? In the age of wellness, we're being inundated with advice on how to live longer, stay healthy, even reverse our biological clock. And on the mild end of the spectrum, there's some pretty solid and unsurprising advice. Eat well, move your body. Maybe if you're taking it a bit more seriously, you've considered adding supplements into the mix. And then there's the extreme end of the longevity spectrum. Billionaires who are trying to biohack their way to a long life, maybe even cheat death indefinitely. Some people are taking it so far that there is a new, unofficial, diagnosis of what is being called longevity fixation syndrome, an intense anxiety that stems from this idea of maximising our health. And it raises the question of whether we're becoming so obsessed with living longer that we're no longer living well. So today I'm asking the man who wrote the book, a book, on living longer and a lifestyle writer who's tried all sorts of wellness treatments along the way, where we should draw the line when it comes to maximising our lifespan. But I also want to hear from you as well. What lengths have you gone to in pursuit of a long and healthy life? Is there something you tried and decided it wasn't worth it? And with me are Sydney Morning Herald lifestyle health editor Sarah Berry and Dr. Norman Swan, co-host of The Health Report and What's That Rash, and the author of several books on living well for longer. Sarah Norman, welcome.
Thanks, Tegan.
Thanks, Tegan.
Sarah, part of your job is road testing health fads. What kinds of things have you tried?
It is. I've tried lots of stuff. I've tried fasts, colonics, ice baths, saunas, hyperbaric oxygen, red light therapy, metabolic chambers. I feel like I've been sort of tested and tracked within an inch of my life.
Is there a particular one that was like, okay, that's too far?
Yes, there was. So I'm not sure if anyone...
Not the colonics?
No, strangely not the colonics. I'm not sure if anyone remembers in about 2011, Malcolm Turnbull lost a lot of weight, I think about 13 kilograms, on a Chinese medicine program called the Wellbeing 101. And I tried that a few years later, and essentially you consume nothing for 2 to 4 weeks, except these sort of sachets of brown herbal tonics, which are about as appetizing as they sound. And then you're on a maintenance program for another sort of 2 to 4 weeks, which involves sort of nothing but maybe a boiled egg and half a cucumber a day. So it's pretty extreme. And during that time, you're also getting acupuncture and sort of daily massages. So I did that until I was hit by a car and in a sort of dazed state. And I haven't fasted since, Tegan.
Do you think that's a real health outcome?
Yeah.
I remember sitting next to Malcolm Turnbull at dinner one night when he was in the middle of it. And I thought, you're doing what? Couldn't believe it.
I'm guessing he wasn't eating.
No, and I think Lucy was pretty skeptical of it at the time.
Yeah, Norman, I want to talk about the fact that you have been reporting on health for the ABC for about 40 years. How have
And
you...
I started when I was 12.
Yeah, I know. Have we always been chasing this, or is this something about the 2020s?
No, this is something that goes back and probably is very ancient. When you were, people were facing death in many, when you were in your 20s, 30s, 40s. And interestingly, life expectancy just keeps on rising. It stalled a little bit with obesity in the last few years, but 3 months a year, year in, year out, we live longer, and going along with living longer, we're living healthier longer without us actually having to try too hard. There are different causes at different phases in history, but it has been an ambition and people have wanted to do it, and they've looked to religion, they've looked to weird diets, they've often looked at sensible things like exercise and being careful with your diet, even in times before science had an explanation for all that.
So we've been obsessed with it for a while. What do you make of this idea of longevity fixation syndrome as a disorder?
I would suspect we're too sensible in Australia to have for too many people to have that. And we don't have the money for it either. These biohacks that are costing Brian Johnson maybe $2 million a year and teams of doctors and lots of supplements and so on. And I think that we're a bit more practical than that. It's easy to become obsessed with it. You asked the call out for calls. I don't know what Sarah's view is. I personally will take whatever I get. This is the only life we have, in my view. And I'll take what I've got as long as I'm healthy and can participate in life. So I don't have a number in mind.
No, neither. Yeah. I want to see my kids grow up. That's about it.
Yeah, I want to know what happens next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the text line, someone says, I'm just trying to make it to the end of the week. It sounds like a hobby for rich people. Okay, Norman, you and me, I'm tired of pretending that we don't know each other very, very well. You and I obviously co-host What's That Rash together, and we've talked about this idea of kind of biohacking your way to a good long life. Is there any evidence behind the kind of more extreme end of the spectrum, this sort of don't die movement?
Like a lot of things that go to the extreme, at the beginning of the journey, there's a core of research which suggests it should work. So if you take, I can't go through the endless list of these supplements, but if you take some of these supplements, so there's anti-diabetes drug, there's NAD, NMN, there's various other preparations that people use, quercetin, and so on. which in the lab with animals or in cell culture do seem to prolong life in a healthy sense. And the frustration is they don't seem to work in real life. And so they're hitting the right targets molecularly. I'm not going to speak for all of them, but some of them do hit the right targets in terms of the core aging process as far as we understand it. But when you look at how they operate in real life, they don't seem to work. And one of the reasons for that is a concept called homeostasis. Our body, first of all, we are much more complex than a mouse or a rat, and certainly than a cell culture. And one of the reasons we are so robust as a species is that our bodies are in balance, and it's called homeostasis. So if our blood pressure goes up, there's a process for bringing it down. If our temperature goes up, there's a process for bringing it down. If certain cellular processes switch on, there's another process to switch it off. Now, what happens with these supplements is they give one supplement in high doses, and I liken it to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. You know, as you age, the tower tilts towards aging, and that's your homeostatic norm. So you're no longer vertical, you're now moving, the tower has aged. And then somebody comes along and tries to prod the tower up in the right kind of way with the right kind of pressure, but the body says, stuff this, and pushes back, because I quite like the angle I'm at now. And it's very hard to push back to the vertical. And I think that what's going to happen over the next few years is that you're going to have to fool the body into slowing down aging artificially. We all do it naturally, and we can come back to that later. But it's probably going to be tiny doses of these in combination. You're going to find the right combination. And maybe it's only once a fortnight that you just give the tower a nudge. In the meantime, what we've got is the boring stuff.
Well, the boring stuff is actually doing us pretty good so far. Like, if we look at life expectancy changes over the last 100 years, it's huge.
It is. But it changes. So life expectancy is an average. It's an average of what, you know, a baby born today, what's the average? And a baby born today in Indooroopilly or in Vaucluse or in Nedlands doesn't have a life expectancy of 83 or 85. That child is going to have a life expectancy of about 100. What drags that, why we've got a lower average is Aboriginal people do not have that life expectancy. People living in disadvantage don't have that life expectancy. So the average is in fact lower. But what everybody listening to our conversation is interested in is lifespan. How long are we as individuals going to live? And life expectancy at birth is what expanded in the 19th century. And then what's expanded since the Second World War is life expectancy at 50. And we've maxed out now at life expectancy at 50. And now it's life expectancy at 75 that's increasing. So you've got to choose where life expectancy is increasing. But what we're interested in is our individual lifespan.
We're all very selfishly interested in our individual lifespan. But what you're saying there is we've got a long way to go still when it comes to equity in allowing kind of anyone who wants to live longer to do so.
Correct.
So on the text line, a couple of people either humble bragging about their genetics or sharing their advice. I have lots of long-lived relatives in my family. None of them got there by obsessing about it. Live a balanced life and have the odd glass of sherry after dinner. Another person says, cutting out sugary sweets from my diet entirely may help me live a longer, healthier life, but I can't do it. Life is too short to go without simple pleasures. Martin says, I just turned 70. I'm aiming for mortality. And so far it's going really well. As I've said to my lovely GP, the thing that's likely to kill me is forgetting to take my heart pills. Sarah, when you're speaking to your readers, what are they telling you about how anxious they feel about making the so-called right choices?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what I'm saying is there's a real reaction to the sort of rates of chronic illness we're seeing. So yes, we've got longer life expectancy, but I think most of us know at least one person who has really suffered with their health or with aging. And so I think there's a sort of a natural response to that, to maybe question what we're doing or to sort of obviously not want the same fate. So I think there is a level of anxiety around our health. And I think also for anyone who has these unresolved health questions. The wellness industry is right there with seemingly all the answers. And I think that that's being sort of amplified on social media. So I think people are sort of questioning, well, is it as basic as, you know, exercise and eating well and, you know, all of the boring basics? But then, you know, I guess the thing I come back to is I think, you know, only 1 in 5 people are doing the recommended physical activity each week, and only 7% of us eat enough fruit and veg. So, yeah, we should probably start there, right?
Well, the boring basics are boring. If you can just give me a pill or a supplement or a 12-week program, then I'll get there faster, right?
That's right. Or just, you know, remove all the plasma from my body and replace it with albumin.
That is a reference to something Brian Johnson has actually done, not just something Sarah's plucked out of thin air.
There is some evidence for that, by the way.
You need to stop talking about that without the caveats, Norman. I want to talk about anxiety as a factor here. Norman, we know that anxiety is bad for our health. If we're so anxious about making all the right choices, does that potentially do us harm as well?
It turns out, this is a sneak preview of a book that I've got that's coming out in August, but it turns out that the brain is important for how well you age. And if you've got a brain that's aging well, the rest of your body tends to age well because the brain controls everything. And therefore, you do want good mental health. And it's not just anxiety. There's probably stronger evidence about depression. But that affects your brain in general. And then, you know, if you're depressed, you're not motivated. It's very hard to motivate yourself to eat well and get exercise and what have you. It's true of anxiety too. So good mental health is really important here.
Sarah, you've rattled off a laundry list before of things that you've tried. Your job requires you to have the, oh gosh, finger on the pulse, sorry for the pun. What's your view on the wellness industry now?
Yeah, look, I think like any industry, there are wonderful parts and wonderful people within it. And, you know, certain things at certain times of my life have been really helpful. But I do think that, you know, often people are turning to this industry at a really vulnerable time in their lives. And I think they're being kind of preyed on, like people are hemorrhaging money in this sort of pursuit. And I think I've become definitely more skeptical of the sort of so-called gurus out there and what they're trying to sell us. I think it just comes back to sort of the boring basics, sadly.
Norman, what are you doing differently than you were doing, say, 10 years ago?
Nothing much, actually. I don't take a single supplement and probably drink a little bit less, but I never drank very much anyway. So I don't think I've changed that much at all. The challenge is just to maintain it. So that you know, if you were exercising a lot 10 years ago, you continue to do so. The natural tendency is to do it less or less intensively. So keeping up the intensity of it and just being careful with your diet. But I'll still have the odd ribeye steak. You know, I'm not totally obsessed with the, you know, for what's that rash, listener? I don't think Tegan's brought the bell in the Mediterranean diet.
I didn't bring my bell in. Yeah. You have to listen to Watch That Rash to get that reference. Paragon of virtue, Dr. Norman Swan. survivor of being hit by a car, Sarah. Barry, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Tegan.
Our pleasure.
Sarah Berry is a lifestyle and health writer for the Sydney Morning Herald. Dr. Norman Swan is a broadcaster, investigative journalist and co-host of Radio National's Health Report and What's That Rash? With me, Tegan Taylor. We answer the health questions everyone's asking. We actually did a recent episode on this called Don't Die, Is Brian Johnson Going to Live Forever? If you want to listen to that, you can search for What's That Rash on ABC Listen. And thank you for your texts about this as well. One person says, honestly, when my body starts to decline, I want to be able to end my life and say goodbye on my terms. Screw slowly falling apart and being kept alive in a home for the elderly. My mum is slowly losing all her normal functioning. I'm 51. Another says, this conversation reminds me of a joke. A man goes to the doctor and he says he wants to live to 150. The doctor asks, are you taking any illegal drugs? He says, no, of course not. Are you having any risky sexual encounters? No, of course not. Are you eating any bad food? Drinking any alcohol? No, the man says, I would never do that. So the doctor looks at him and says, why do you want to live to 150 then? One other thing I should mention is Wellness 101, which Sarah mentioned at the beginning. The practitioner was deregistered for 3 years in 2024 after a complaint involving a woman who died after reporting to hospital with potassium deficiency and cardiac arrhythmia. If you just needed to put an even stronger point on how risky a regime like that is. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, why do we find some voices more attractive than others? Do you reckon you can tell how attractive someone is just by the sound of their voice? Maybe you prefer a deep, husky tone when you hear someone speak? I'll just give you one example.
I never aim towards being a role model. I aim towards being the man that the 12-year-old Luke Bateman needed to see growing up, because he never got that.
That is the gravelly tones of former footy player and book talker Luke Bateman, who was on Radio National Life Matters recently. Well, anyway, new research has looked into the question of which voices we find more attractive and how our sexuality might shape the kinds of voices we're drawn to. And you might not be surprised to learn that the way we consider voices has to do with their depth, and those deep voices are considered more attractive to everyone except straight men. So what shapes how we talk and what we want from a voice? And how do our voices reflect power, status, and our place in the world? Well, with me to chat about it is Kate Medill, Director of the Voice Research Laboratory at the University of Sydney. How do you rate your own voice on a scale of 1 to 10, Kate?
Oh, what a great question. Today, right now, this morning, probably I'd rate it about a 9. Oh, I'm pretty happy with my voice.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love to hear
some
it.
Days not, some days it's different. Some days it's a 5 or a 6.
What, especially in winter when you're shaking off a bit of a cold or something. Although that can deepen your voice a bit.
Well, it can, but it depends how deep do you want to go. And does it go croaky when you go deep? Because that makes a big difference to how people perceive you.
All right, talk me through this. What are we listening for when we're listening for these things?
Well, first of all, we're listening for the pitch of the voice, how high or low we hear it. That's why having a croaky or clear voice is important, because the clearer the voice is, the more easily we can detect the pitch of the voice. The lower we go, however, we'll get to a point where we have to go croaky if we want to go any lower. That's the vocal fry a phenomenon. We're also listening for what we call formants. This is a bit of deep physical science here, but basically when we make a sound wave with our vocal cords, they flutter open and closed, that moves the air around. Those sound waves bounce back and forth inside our throat. And the shape of our throat boosts some of those sound waves and damps others. And what we boost, we call a formant. What that means is that sounds that travel through a big, wide, long tube sound very different to sounds, the same type of sound or the same pitch that sounds that travels through a small, narrow tube. So, you know, a middle C on a tuba sounds very different to a middle C on a piccolo or a flute. Mm. And that's because the shape of the tube is changing the power in different frequencies, and our ear is sensitive to that. And we read that information as relating to size. Pitch is the same. The longer vocal cords you have, the lower your pitch can be, because they can vibrate more slowly. The shorter they are, the faster they vibrate. So pitch and formants tell us about the size of the instrument that is making that sound. Therefore, it's related to the size of our bodies.
So this research found that humans, apart from straight men, basically preferred lower, deeper voices. Is there some sort of biological ping going off in there that a big body attached to a deep voice is maybe a protector?
Yes, absolutely. But it is interesting that in this particular piece of research, they found that both homosexual men and heterosexual women preferred masculinized voices. So they synthetically masculinized the voice. Although the interesting thing about this research is that the listeners didn't like the changed voice, because they compared them to just a normal baseline. The first big finding was don't change your voice, because people don't find what they perceive to be an altered voice very attractive at all. But the interesting thing too was that the heterosexual men found more feminized voices more attractive. And this is what we would expect. The voice is our most primitive communicator, the sound of our voice. So we're born using it without words. We convey so much information fundamentally in it. But it is asexual, it does relate to our size and shape, but also to our sexuality, because, of course, size and shape is relative to that. Females tend to be smaller. They definitely have shorter throats and shorter vocal cords, whereas males tend to have bigger bodies, they have bigger throats and longer vocal cords. In the main, of course, there's always that bell curve that says there's exceptions. So we identify a voice very much as being masculine or feminine. We're very sensitive to that. So it sort of makes sense that, in a way, that heterosexual males were more attracted to more feminized voices. The really interesting part is not that the women were attracted to more masculine voices, but that the heterosexual men the homosexual men found the male voice just as attractive. That sort of makes sense as well. So we're very much signing our sexuality around how we respond to voices.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Kate Medill from the Voice Research Laboratory at the University of Sydney about very important new research about what we find attractive in voices. And it turns out that pretty much everyone, with the exception of straight men, prefer deeper voices in general. I'm asking you about the sexiest voice you know. I promise I wasn't fishing for this, but Tony says Tegan Taylor's voice, 9.9 out of 10. Thank you. Another person says sexiest voice, Norman Swan, and I'm a straight middle-aged man. and another one says Dave McCormack should get a mention, Bluey's dad, Bandit. Yeah, how do we perceive voices in cartoon dogs, Kate?
Oh, that's a great question, and I really don't have much of an answer. I think what we probably tend to do is we look for stereotypes, because cartoons emphasize stereotypes in so many ways. That's why I think possibly Bluey's such a phenomenon, because it's not so stereotypical. It's much more real life. So, yeah, that's an area of research I can't say I'm strong in.
So, one of the things that research has discovered is that women's voices have changed over time. They're getting lower. Is this a physical thing, or is this a social thing?
My personal opinion is that it's much more of a social thing, because we haven't really seen major physiological changes in women's larynxes as documented over time. But we have seen very big changes in women's level of empowerment, especially in westernised societies. And of course, as I was saying earlier, the voice is a really important signal, not only of our sexuality, but of our power and status. In fact, research done back in the 1980s by a Queensland researcher, Geoffrey Pittam, found, it was a beautiful piece of research actually, he found that the voice really signed two major things. This was before the sex research came in. And that was that when we hear a voice, we make a judgment about how powerful the other person is, what their status is, and whether they are like us. So he called it a solidarity index. So are they part of my tribe? Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, because, if you're sort of back, thousands of years ago, wandering around on a plane out in the middle of the wilderness, and you come across another human and you hear them talking before you see them, you need to know, are you a threat or are you part of my tribe? And the voice, our brain is tuned to listen and make judgments about that. So it's a very, very primitive response.
If we convey status and power through voice, are there different standards for men and women?
Certainly, some of the early research done in vocal fry and creak would suggest that there is. Certainly, my own research many years ago demonstrated that men make different judgments about women's voices and men's voices, and vice versa. So the effect of different vocal characteristics is judged differently. So vocal fry in a male is often seen as indicating more status. Vocal fry in a female is often seen as being indicating that they're more neurotic, they're less trustworthy, etc. So there really is in a way, a double standard around our listening behaviour. But that's probably because there's this very complex interaction between judgments of attraction, and that's what this research was talking about. Am I attracted to this voice? Versus, is this person like me? Have they got more power than me? So those two sort of domains can sometimes be in tension, and sometimes they can be congruent. And so it makes it not reliable how we may judge other people's voices. The other thing that is not sort of talked about in the research, but we've investigated in our lab, is the effect of articulation. We've got a study that we're just publishing at the moment that showed that Australian-speaking gay men produced their pitch with much larger variation, and they pronounced their S sound with a slightly higher tongue position, which is more of a feminine type of trait. So, in fact, you know, there we can have a sexuality, but then we can be gender non-conforming. We can be self-identified according to be straight or gay acting. We can have a sense of outness or not. We can have internalized homophobia. All of those factors will affect how we communicate. And the other thing that we must say is that it depends who we think we're talking to. We always change the way that we speak dependent on who we think is listening.
That is so interesting. I wish we had more time to talk about it, Kate, but we do need to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tegan. All the best.
One text says, I've been told more than a few times that I have a sexy voice. My voice is deep and soft, and I occasionally lisp. Once I was invited away for the weekend, sight unseen, by a client's bank manager I spoke to regularly. Anyway, the texter goes on to say that someone who'd heard their voice finally cross paths told my friend, she sounds really sexy, but she's not like that in real life. And Naomi says, why do we so often get a shock when we see the face that belongs to a voice? How do we build up a picture of who would own a particular voice? Great questions, Naomi. Well, earlier in the show, you heard from Churchill Fellow Sam Whiting on the alternative business models for small music venues overseas. And he described the calculation that a lot of small venues have to make when they're setting ticket price as part of the problem.
Entry was always double the price of a pint, right? So if a pint was £5, it'd be £10 to get in. And what I've noticed across the small to medium sector for a long time is that the price of beer keeps rising, but we're not charging more for small to medium gigs. So I think we have a problem where we don't really value as a society, but also as a sector, that end of the talent pipeline, so to speak. So what I've been looking at is alternative ownership and operating models for venues to sort of re-emphasize the cultural and sort of the public value of music for our communities.
That's Churchill Fellow Sam Whiting. Talking to me earlier in the show. I do recommend go back, listen to that full chat. It was really interesting. You can find it by searching Life Matters on ABC Listen. Earlier in the show, you were telling me about the famous acts that you saw at small venues before they got too famous. And there's been some pretty big humble bragging on the text line, but the one that has absolutely blown my socks off, Fiona says, I'm old enough to have seen the Beatles at the Cave. I was too young, but snuck in by my mum. Incredible. We also spoke about sexy voices and which voices you find most attractive. Susan says, I used to think Sean Connery had the sexiest voice, hands down. But then I found out about some of his views on women and hitting, which ruined everything. So it really is the whole package. Izzy says, I'm happy with my voice, but would swap with Kate Blanchett. Another says, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson has the sexiest voice. I go to sleep with him every night. But that is just about it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the fact that more and more of the beverage aisle in your local supermarket is dominated by the zero alcohol varieties of famous alcohol brands. Is this a healthy alternative, or is it a foot in the door to get us to drink more? That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'll catch you then.